last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Now, our next guest is one of Ireland's most experienced and best rugby writers, going back over decades. And he has put together a new book called Touching Distance, Irish Rugby's Battle with Great Expectations. Brendan Fanning, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Matt.
I think there's great timing on this because expectations seem to be shifting a little bit amongst a lot of Irish rugby fans. After what happened in Croke Park last weekend, is there a feeling maybe, and given a series of results for Leinster, despite winning the URC, that they've peaked? Are the other provinces on the way back up? Or is it that overall, when you look at the Irish squad and a lot of trepidation about the matches coming up, starting in Chicago against New Zealand next week because of the age of the Irish squad, are we at a bit of a turning point or even a tipping point for Irish rugby?
It's going to be a really interesting season, and you're right, a lot of people are unsure about what's coming down the pipe, by which I mean they're not particularly optimistic. Part of that is down to the natural hangover that follows the Lions. So I would expect this to be a rough November, and we should hold off on doomsday predictions until we see how November pans out and then how the Six Nations goes. But I wouldn't have great expectations in the wake of the Lions tour.
Why not? You know, because that's what a lot of people outside of rugby would say. Well, if most of your best players are picked to play for the best team from Britain and Ireland, and they win out in Australia, and there's 10 Irishmen on the pitch at any one time, shouldn't that then just continue on into internationals for Ireland? That if they're the best players in this part of the world, then surely they should be able to beat lots of other countries.
And if they were machines, that is exactly how it would go. But there's always a hangover after a tour like that, after an incredibly long season. And yeah, the age thing is a factor, and that poses another question.
So hang on, Tadhg Byrne didn't have a hangover in Croke Park last Saturday, and he's 33.
Because he plays for Munster, Matt. Munster, who are now the leading province in Ireland.
Don't get smart with me.
No, but by the way, that I think that was really, really good for business. We're kind of fed up with the dominance of Leinster over Munster, and yeah, it's hard for Leo Cullen, and his situation is pretty precarious at the minute. But I think from a rugby point of view, for the business of rugby, it was absolutely really good. And moreover, we've always in this country had a fascination about the number 10 jersey and the people contesting it. And funny enough, Ollie Campbell was at the launch of this book last night in Clontarf Rugby Club, looking as fresh and fit as ever. And I was chatting to him about this whole, the fascination we have without halves.
Which goes back to his battle with Tony Ward in 1979.
Exactly. So the timing for Jack Rowley just could not have been any better.
Indeed. But doesn't it put it up to Andy Farrell in that even if he was minded to continue with Sam Prendergast to 10 to continue his development, might it not undermine him with the entire squad if they saw a player who's demonstrably in better form and who has reacted to being dropped still being excluded, if it was the case that Farrell is minded to go with Prendergast next weekend?
Farrell's control is probably the wrong word, but his influence over the squad is such that I'd say he could present a box of oranges and tell them they're apples and the lads would be prepared to accept it because it's coming from him. They have such trust in him. The only way that it will change is if there was a series of crazy selections backed up by a series of really punishing defeats. That would may change the mood music. But I spoke to a lot of people. Andy Farrell wouldn't cooperate with the writing of this book. Fair enough, he was writing his own book. I spoke to a lot of people around the subject of Farrell and his ascension to the throne and how he conducts his business. And the closest I came to somebody saying something negative about him was a source who said initially when Farrell took over from Joe Schmidt, there was a bit of forced fun about the camp, which I think is probably understandable given that
what it had been like under Joe Schmidt.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. But just on Andy Farrell's situation, he is taking a little bit of flack about relying so heavily on the Leinster production line and squad, and also on keeping players there who are older. Now, I think if you look at it, he has actually moved some younger players into the squad over the last year and has continued it with this squad. But isn't his big issue that the World Cup draw is in December And your rankings going into that are going to be very important as to who you might draw. So he can't really take chances, can he, with his selections against New Zealand, Japan, Australia and South Africa? Because if he was to say, let's see how the young fellas do, and they were to lose all four matches, that could have major repercussions for the World Cup, couldn't it?
Have you ever seen him take chances so far?
No.
No, nor have I. And he was very loyal to the senior.
Sorry, you could say except putting Sam Prendergast in instead of Jack Rowley in the first place.
Yeah, but we were all jumping up and down saying, my God, what a brilliant player Sam Prendergast is. Have you ever seen a fella with that level of calm under pressure? And I remember the press conference at the time. Everybody was talking about, you know, how is Sam? What is he like around the squad? And Andy was going on about it and everybody else was going on about it, how relaxed he was. And by extension, it became what an inspired selection. But the question you raise is interesting, because already people are saying, if you project forward to the World Cup, two-thirds of the team will be in their 30s, of the current side. So do you start dropping players now because you don't think they're going to be around in 2 years' time? And if you do, in my opinion, that's derelict. Test rugby is... Do you know why test rugby is called test rugby?
Because it's a genuine test of the best.
It's the test of our best against the test of your best. So you don't put a guy in on the basis of what you hope he's going to be doing in 18 months' time or 2 years' time. You put the guy in who is in the position, the best man in the position at the time. There is some leeway. Every November, one of your four games is not going to be tier one. And it affords you an opportunity not to apply the rigid rule of picking the best all the time. Farrell has, for two reasons, Farrell has to be picking his best team. One is because, as you've alluded to, the World Cup ranking. Secondly, that's just the way business is done in Test rugby. You don't send out a bunch of greenhorns and hope that it works all. And moreover, when you do that, you then have to turn around to the guy who you passed over and explain it to him.
Okay, Great Expectations is part of the title of the book. And I think we've, on a number of occasions in this country, gone into World Cups with the greatest expectation that we could actually go and win it. And yet we don't get past the quarter final. So are our expectations, given the size of the nation in the first place, the size of the country, and also the size of the rugby playing population, perhaps excessive?
The expectations are born in the season leading up to the World Cup. If we've had a miserable season and our squad are all over the place, the expectations are low. If we have had a good season and things are going well, our expectations are high. If you go back to 2007 and the post-World Cup report, there was lots of talk about the expectation right across the squad was we'll get to the last four. Ireland's form over the previous couple of years have been really good. There was every reason to think that we would go well. And then there was just the complete and utter cock-up with the preparation. But you wouldn't say, in recent years, you look at 2015, 2019, 2023, there were no huge cock-ups of that nature. In 2015, the squad was not as deep as Joe would have wanted it. So then when we ran into trouble against France on the injury and suspension front, suddenly four or five frontliners were gone in the blink of an eye.
And we couldn't cope.
And we couldn't cope with that. If you go back to France in 2023, that end game in New Zealand, or against New Zealand rather, maybe exposed an attack shape that New Zealand had read. They had suffered.
That Joe Smith had read.
Yeah, that they had suffered at our hands when we went down there and won the series the previous summer. And they worked it out. And, you know, maybe we should have been able to throw something more at them in that end game. But then again, if Ronan Kelleher got that ball down, it probably would have been a different outcome.
Indeed. The book is fascinating the way you've broken it into the various provinces and then sort of run through the years and the various issues. I took a lot of interest, obviously, in the Munster one, given my background down in Munster. But the St. Michael's chapter is very interesting because St. Michael's is a school in Dublin, a boys' secondary school, which has become dedicated to producing rugby players, not just to win the school's cup in Leinster, but to provide them for professional rugby afterwards. Andy Farrell was with us on the programme recently on the publication of his book. And I don't think he quite liked the question that I asked him about whether given his own background and the toughness of rugby league and the working class upbringing, as to whether maybe perhaps some of the lads coming through the South County Dublin private school rugby background are quite tough enough when it comes to the business end of big games, and that this has hurt Ireland and hurt Leinster as well. As a Northside dub, what do you think?
I would have more. First of all, I recognise what Michaels have done, and institutions like BlackRock, which is an institution, and they have they are extremely good at what they do, and their attention to detail and the resources they throw at it are beyond question. My issue is not so much that there aren't enough Northside dubs involved.
I'm only joking on that.
No, I know, but I understand where you're coming from on that. My issue would be that we have, we're victims of our own system, because the system is successful and because Ireland are successful relative to our numbers. It has induced a degree of comfort. So we think that everything we are doing is right. And we believe that more and more when other people come in to watch and come over and say, oh, geez, what is the Irish system? We must do, like, the number of times over the years I've had Welsh and Scottish colleagues coming on to me saying, what about the Irish system? How is it so good? How do you produce so many players? And we there is no urgency. There is no, Jesus, if we don't fix this, we're in trouble, about finding players who are different, genetically different. So we've a lot of skinny white guys who went to private schools and came through that system and proved themselves disciplined and able to cope with the rigour of that system. And they're brave and they're athletic and they're, you know, they're most of them are pretty intelligent footballers, but not a lot of them have that X factor, that's something different. And they don't just rock up and say, I'd like to come and find go play your game. You really need a coherent and aggressive program to unearth them and get them in.
You see, obviously there are players who have had the X factor coming from the Dublin private school background. Brian O'Driscoll is the most obvious example of that. What I suppose I'm touching at is, I was very taken in Andy Farrell's book about the working class rugby league background, and very much struck me that if Andy Farrell had grown up in Ireland, he would have been a Gaelic footballer. He would have fitted into that sort of GAA complex rather than a rugby union one. And often, say, for example, the success that Munster would have had in the noughties was on the back of AIL players, but often with a bit of a GAA background and a little bit maybe of that mental toughness. It took them time to develop it, but they got over the line on occasions. And I know you can say Leinster have had an enormous amount of Champions Cup wins as well. But in recent years, as we've been celebrating this production line more, that maybe just that little bit, I know there's been Grand Slams and the rest of it, but in some of the big games, you just wonder, are some of these players as tough and as ruthless as you'd want them to be?
Well, you mentioned the GAA. I can't watch a GAA game now. I couldn't look at the Limerick hurlers for the last 4 or 5 years without slotting them into positions on the rugby field.
Sure, their half back line at one stage was bigger than the Irish back row.
But not just their physique, their everything about them. They had an absolutely savage competitiveness about them. Their skill levels were off the charts. And I'd say, you know, regularly to other people, if it wasn't for the GAA, we'd be winning World Cups, you know, comfortably. And years ago, Matt, when I wrote the first book, From There to Here, which dealt with the madness of our transition from amateurism to pro, I remember talking to a senior IRFU guy at the time and asking him why we don't get after more GAA players to come and play rugby. And he said, oh, no, well, they have their ways and we have our ways and we're quite comfortable in our little part of the playing field, honestly. And I thought, man, this is pre-professionalism. And because they didn't like the idea of professionalism, it took them ages to get into the game of going and getting players from other games. And bear in mind, Matt, and I've come up against this through coaching youth, trying to hang on to players in rugby when I'm sharing them with GAA clubs. And I'm trying to make the sell that this kid can wear a green of Ireland. He's not going to do that playing GAA. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And they throw back the Féile at you and they throw back into the All-Irelands and whatever. It is an unbelievably strong connection. And the level of competitiveness that they engender is really, really impressive. But we as in rugby, need to get after them and get more talented GAA players playing rugby.
Well, just to finish on that, I mean, just if I talk about Munster briefly, they seem to be now getting players out of traditional Gaelic football strongholds in Cork. But, and I know Limerick is more of an urban game for rugby and more of a rural game from Limerick, but it seems that Limerick is very much now not producing the rugby players anymore because of the strength of the hurling.
Which poses a problem for Ian Costello down in Munster. So he acknowledges that schools rugby is, you know, on the edge of a cliff.
Three schools in Cork, essentially.
Compared to the rest of the country. So if you go into Ardskill Reach or wherever, in whatever schools in Limerick, and say, I'm going to put in Joe Bloggs here, and he's going to be your new rugby coordinator, and I'm going to give you X, Y, and Z, they may well say to you, well, that's great, but we're actually a GAA school now.
And Christian's Brothers College in Cork has taken hurlers who should be with the North Mon, but that's another story indeed. Brendan Fanning, great having you with us. I really enjoying the book. Really interesting, different insight into where we are with Irish rugby. It's called Touching Distance, Irish Rugby's Battle with Great Expectations.
The last word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.